listen to this podcast.
Welcome to I Am the Podman, a Beatles podcast review. As you may have guessed, I am the Podman.
No, you're not,
said little Nicola. I Am the Podman will take a magical look at podcasts about the Beatles and review them for accuracy, production value, and entertainment value, and then answer the question, is this podcast worth listening to? As always, I'm recording in studio number 2 at Shabby Road Studios. Number 2, number 2, number 2. Which, when turned back to front, sounds suspiciously like, turn me on, Podman. Turn me on, Podman. Turn me on, Podman. And yes, I know that would sound much better in stereo, but George Martin insists that the podcast be in mono. Thank you for listening, and please don't forget to like and subscribe, preferably before you listen to the show. Thanks again for listening. A splendid time is guaranteed for all. Episode 5. Five Piece in a Pod, 2024. A Pot of Gold. Beatles news keeps coming at the speed of light. In late February, it was announced that Sony Films will finance and distribute 4 films, one about each Beatle, to be directed by Sam Mendes. The 4 separate films, slated for 2027 release, will each tell the Beatles story from each Beatle's point of view, and the films will intersect to, quoting the press release, tell the astonishing story of the greatest band in history. In a statement, director Sam Mendes says, I'm honored to be telling the story of the greatest rock band of all time, and excited to challenge the notion of what constitutes a trip to the movies. Sony Pictures must have a great deal of faith to open these 4 interrelated films all in the same year. While the special release details will be revealed in the future, Sony Pictures promises the strategy will be, quote, innovative and groundbreaking. All of this sounds very interesting, but from my experience, I can attest that Hollywood very rarely does anything that can be considered innovative and groundbreaking. Still, I'm interested and I'm hoping for some interesting storytelling and editing, something like Memento or Irreversible. Even the brilliantly crafted, while still being a pretty bad TV show, How I Met Your Mother. Something different. I'm hoping that Sam Mendes is the right directorial choice. It will be interesting to see how this turns out. But here's the bigger problem. Casting. You know how most Beatle tribute bands fail when it comes to the vocals? You had 2 of the most amazing voices in all of rock history in the Beatles. And while Paul's voice is incredible, no one, and I mean no one, can sound like John Lennon. And aside from them, George's voice is fascinating and very idiosyncratic. This is where the sound-alike bands falter. Now, in the upcoming films, it appears they will be using actual Beatles music, and that's a good thing. But casting, who do you get to play 4 of the most charismatic figures of all time? Frankly, even if we go through a list of the greatest actors in film history, Brando, Bogart, Hopkins, McKellen, as skilled as these thespians may be, even as much, much younger men. I can't imagine any of them as the Beatles, and that's going to be a problem for Mendes. The other problem is us. Yes, we are going to be a huge problem. I mean, Robert Carlyle is a fine actor, and he played John for about 2 minutes in the movie Yesterday. And do you remember how much Beatle bitching you heard? Imagine, rather than 2 minutes, it's for 2 hours. Ah, pity the fool. I love movies and I love music, but I can count on my Yakuza diminished fingers the number of rock biopics that I really enjoyed. Kurt Russell played a fine Elvis in a made-for-TV movie in the 70s, and amazingly enough, Gary Busey, of all people, was okay as Buddy Holly. While Lou Diamond Phillips didn't make you want the plane to crash, it didn't do Ritchie Valens justice. Angela Bassett was almost as sexy as Tina herself in What's Love Got to Do with It, but Angela Bassett could play Aunt Esther and make it sexy. I know the movie Bohemian Rhapsody was well-loved, but I was offended by the twitchy, special-needs portrayal of Freddie Mercury. Rami Malek's caricature was insulting to Mercury, and I shut off the movie halfway through. And that speaks to the talent and charisma of those rock stars who have a sufficient amount of public interest to warrant someone spending millions to make a movie about them. And of course, the Beatles movies will be aimed at the general public. They have to be. So complex issues are dumbed down so the audience can easily understand the narrative. So if I'm still around in 2027, I'll stop at the bookstore and pick up my Lewisohn Unabridged Volume 2 and go see at least the first of these Sam Mendes movies. But tonight, I'm kicking back and watching Bob Zemeckis' 2012 motion-captured film Yellow Submarine.
Many more of them live next door, and the band begins to play.
Yellow submarine. jolly good chats, the jolly good chats. We take it once more.
Welcome to I Am the Podman, a Beatles podcast review. Everybody thinks they know about the Podman, but how much do we really know? Probably not as much as we think we do. Let's look at a podcast. Well, it's really not a podcast, even though it's presented by two of the top Beatles podcasters, Stephen Cockcroft and Jason Carty, the Beatle Brains of Ireland, and the brains responsible for one of the Podman's favorite podcasts, Nothing Is Real. You can bet I will be talking about the fabulous podcast Nothing Is Real on a future episode. But today, in keeping with our nominally Irish theme, I'll be looking at Stephen and Jason's four-part BBC series, Give the Beatles Back to the Irish.
Everybody knows the Beatles came from Liverpool, right? Wrong. They actually came from Ireland, and we're here to prove it, sort of. I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft, and we are the current Beatle Brains of Ireland, and for the last few years we've been making a podcast called Nothing Is Real, looking at the cultural impact of the Beatles from the 1960s to the present day.
But there's a bigger question at play, which is, are the Beatles Ireland's biggest band?
In the first episode, they talk about the Beatles' first visit to Ireland in November 1963, and note that Liverpool is often called the capital of Ireland. They go over each of the Beatles' Irish roots and note that George is the most Irish, while Ringo is the least. The Beatles' first concert in Ireland is November 7th, 1963, in Dublin at the Adelphi, in the midst of their 1963 British tour. They played two shows, and between shows, a riot ensued, while the crowd from the first show didn't want to leave. The guys note that screenwriter Alan Owen is traveling with the Beatles at this time, observing for color to use on a script for A Hard Day's Night. One wonders if the Fabs, escaping the Adelphi after their evening show, crammed into the back of a news van, was inspiration for a scene in the movie. Episode 2 discusses Beatlemania in Belfast and the fascinating story of Ringo's residence in Dublin, which was an on-paper scam to get a driver's license. Ringo had driven his Ford Zephyr for years, although he did not have a driver's license and he had no formal driving training. At that time, you did not need to do a driving test in Ireland. Of course, this changed on St. Patrick's Day in 1964. The Beatles played Dublin on November 7th and Belfast on November 8th. In Belfast, they played at the Ritz Cinema to scenes of utter hysteria. The theater manager had the bright idea to walk the Beatles out after the concert right out the front door. The Beatles play Belfast again on November 2nd, 1964, and Cockcroft and Carty describe the odd circumstances around that performance. This concert, in King's Hall, played to 1,600 people in one day, which was the biggest concert they ever played in the British Isles, and it was the last one in Ireland. In Episode 3, Stephen and Jason discuss John and George's March 1964 holiday with Sin and Paddy Boyd at Drumherlin Castle in Ireland. The story of Tara Brown is related. Tara is a good friend of Paul and Mike McCartney and a co-investor with George Harrison in Sevilla's nightclub. Tara was Paul's trip sitter on his first LSD trip and, this is unconnected to the LSD trip, was riding mopeds with Paul when Paul crashed his moped. The results are visible in the paperback rider video. Sadly, in December 1966, Tara is killed in a car crash, which of course is part of the inspiration for the greatest song of all time.
And though the news was rather sad,
John's purchase of the 19-acre Dornish Island is discussed. John visits Dornish Island in 1968 and has the acetate of Revolution and plays it at dinner for the hotel staff. Unfortunately, John never visits Dornish again, and the island is sold in 1983. In the final episode, the lads talk about John's political protests and marches for Irish civil rights. This, of course, leads to a discussion of the Sometime in New York City album. The Luck of the Irish was started in November 1971 and was intended as the first single from that album. We get to 30 January 1972, Bloody Sunday. John and Paul met in New York in January 1972 and discuss a sort of truce from insulting each other in the press and in song. They then separately both react to Bloody Sunday by writing songs, Paul's Give Ireland Back to the Irish and John's Sunday Bloody Sunday. Stephen and Jason compare the two songs, pointing out that Paul's first line, "Great Britain, you are tremendous," while John's contains the line, "You Anglo pigs and Scotties sent to colonize the North, you wave your bloody Union Jacks and you know what it's worth." And my two pence, I think this is an interesting commentary on the weaknesses that are exposed when John and Paul are not working together and able to use each other as sounding boards. We then hear that George wrote "Sunshine Life for Me, Sail Away Raymond," while he and Patty were staying at Kessel Martin in County Kildare. The trip came shortly after the High Court in London had ruled in Paul's favor against the other three Beatles, thus placing Apple Records into receivership. The Raymond of the song is an attorney hired by Alan Klein to represent the original Threedles to defend against Paul's suit. George's assessment of Raymond's legal skill appears to instruct him to sail away. While George says he intended the song to be an Irish ditty, Ringo's version recorded with the band for his Ringo album in 1973 is pure foot-stompin' country. Paul gets married, Ringo's all-star band plays a concert, and in 2023, Paul plays in Dublin. They talk about Paul's book, The Lyrics, and Irish poet Paul Muldoon, who interviewed Paul McCartney for the book, and subsequently those recordings are currently being used as a podcast. But I will never talk about that podcast, unless you keep listening to this episode. So is this four-part series worth your time? Obviously it is. Stephen Cockcroft and Jason Carty have one of the best podcasts about the Fabs, Nothing Is Real. And their friendly, warm, dare I say, Irish personalities, coupled with fantastic research and a wonderful wit, make Nothing Is Real, as well as Give the Beatles Back to Ireland, a must-listen. They follow up this series, by the way, with an episode entitled Give Kate Bush Back to the Irish. So the hits keep coming. So this March 17th, pour yourself a nice Irish beverage and relax in your greenest attire and enjoy Give the Beatles Back to the Irish. We'll be right back.
ski an wischt sie die Suhrs, Vater he. Bau a feu, sonnen jid gut hock all die. Bon du schein durnei, top und skal wat hule schau vergeht. Vater he. Sun and geek it is the suit on the ski. On the ski. Shock and all is moon and
here's a little section I like to call Media City.
Whoa!
No, no, John, it's Media City, not Meat City.
So, sorry, Mr. Podman, sir. I completely misunderstood. I hope you can forgive me.
Not to worry, Johnny. You are forgiven.
Thank you kindly.
The concept of the Media City segment of the podcast was intended to be a quick shout-out to media related to the Fab Four. But the past few episodes, actually all of them, save episode one, have featured fairly comprehensive Media City segments. I kind of feel that the brief mention I made of Andrew Milton's fab YouTube channel isn't sufficient, and I will definitely be revisiting Parlagram auctions in the future. But today on Media City, I'll look at the new movie Argyle, just released in the U.S. on February the 2nd, 2024. The film received justifiably negative reviews and is yet to even earn 50% of its $200 million budget. The Hollywood Reporter estimates that a $500 million gross would be needed for the movie to even break even. At a 6:20 show on a Tuesday night, I was one of only four people in the theater. The film is directed by Matthew Vaughn, who pathetically has the tagline, quote, from the twisted mind of Matthew Vaughn, on all the advertising, with an $80 million advertising budget, by the way. So if your career has been on a pathetically downward spiral since, some would say, 2011, but I'd say 2007, it's a desperate attempt to appear to be edgy and relevant when you self-proclaim ownership of a twisted mind, eh? The film script, although, quite honestly, most of the dialogue is so inane that it could have been ad-libbed, was written by Jason Fuchs. The music is by Lauren Balfe, and I'll talk much more about that later. I don't want to talk about the movie itself too much. Suffice it to say, I'm not blazing any trails here when I'm agreeing with virtually all of the critics and saying that this is a dreadful movie, a bait-and-switch advertising campaign, and a plot that is a pale ripoff of many other, much better movies. So the movie is about a secret agent, Aubrey Argyle, played by Henry Cavill, who has one of the most idiotic haircuts. But that's okay, since he's only in the 2-hour and 20-minute movie for about 4 minutes. And the antagonist, LaGrange, is played by the beautiful Dua Lipa. For about a total screen time of 2 minutes. So if you saw the trailer, a TV commercial, or even the movie poster, and you chose to see this movie based on any of those,
you got played.
Instead, you get Ron Howard's daughter. And after this and 8 days a week, can we just agree not to let any members of Opie's family have anything to do with the Beatles? And that includes the rumored casting of Clint Howard as Paul McCartney in the Sam Mendes movies. And Sam Rockwell trying his best. Toward the end of the movie, Bryce Howard is in a horrible gold gown and Rockwell in a dopey green Nehru jacket. Either he's supposed to be a leprechaun, or it's clear that the two of them strongly resemble Miss Piggy and Kermit, albeit with none of the charm. In summation, BBC reviewer Nicholas Barber writes, quote, "It's a painful collection of silly cliches and unconvincing special effects, but the twist is that it's supposed to be like that," end quote. I agree. So the Podman's review, it's beyond bad, and it's evil and disgusting. So skip it. Wait. Did I just say evil and disgusting? Bad, yes, even horrible. But evil and disgusting? Well, that's where, unfortunately, the Beatles come in. And rest assured, I wouldn't waste the breath on this rubbish, except for the inclusion of the Beatles in this dumpster fire. Apparently the director, Matthew Vaughn, a director who of late seems to only direct what Mel Brooks would call Men in Tights movies, is dear friends with a certain Giles Martin. Well, let's let the kiddie movie director tell the story.
I'm friends with Giles Martin, who produced the song, and I was with Giles about a year and a half ago. I was like, "Giles, I'm struggling finding a song, a love song, that has pathos but hope." Mm. Most songs are either, love songs are either really sad or really happy. They don't really do both. And he goes, "Well, I got a new Beatles song. Do you want to hear it?" And I was like, "Yeah, shut up." And he went, "No." And Giles is a massive, massive joker. And then he played it to me. And I was like, I can't believe I'm hearing a new Beatles song. And it was John Lennon singing. And I'm like, what is going on? But I was listening to the lyrics going, this sums up the movie Now and Then. I'm like, what the hell? And then we literally just slapped it on the movie. We didn't have to re-edit a single scene. It was written for the movie. And then we orchestrated it just for the hell of it. We're done. This is unbelievable. And then had to get permission, which was an absolute joy to meet Sir Paul McCartney and speak to all the other members of the Beatles and the members of the Beatles family who are no longer with us. And what an honor that I got to. If somebody had said to me, "You will end up getting to work with the Beatles on their last ever song in your film," I would have said, "You're out of your mind." So it was a privilege and an honor. And I feel blessed and extremely lucky that happened.
So Now and Then, the last song ever by the greatest band of all time, a song that many of us feel is John Lennon's ode to his former band, his brothers. A song that's lyrics contained the last words that John Lennon ever spoke to his soulmate and brother, Paul McCartney. Make its first appearance in Argyle when a fat cat lady is listening to it while spending the night alone with her cat. So misused in this context gives the song the connotation of being about a crazy cat woman. What follows is frequent snippets of Now and Then, here and there. Some may, and I emphasize, may be a slightly different mix. Perhaps it's just my unfamiliarity with the Atmos mix, that are shoehorned in, frankly, haphazardly, and several orchestral versions that were orchestrated by the movie's soundtrack composer. And by the way, I am being consciously pejorative by using the term movie rather than film. A fellow named Lauren Balfe, listening to his "I've got an orchestra, but I'm not sure how it works" orchestrations, make me wonder why Matthew Vaughn didn't just use his buddy Giles Martin's orchestrations. Let's listen to Lauren Balfe explain his use of the music, and then we'll hear from Giles Martin, or Miles Martin, as Matthew Vaughn calls his dear friend.
There's a great new element to the film, which is the Beatles song, which doesn't happen every day. But we've been able to incorporate that into the score. So you will be hearing it coming as source, but also we've actually started using it as her main theme that comes in and out during certain sequences to remind her of her past. I think that when you first hear the song, there's so much that connects the DNA to the Beatles that when you start hearing it, you feel already a connection to it. The melody is so classic and beautiful, it already sounds like that we've lived with it for the last 40 years. So it's a trigger device for Eddie. The song's used as a trigger. And you'll see that school uses it, but also the music box uses it, which is very important in the film.
The Beatles are what the biggest selling artists of all time by a country mile. I like the idea about them appealing to a new audience, and it makes sense, and it really works in the movie. It's become an integral part of the movie. But it's so much more satisfying to have music that's used in a film that's not just a needle drop, not just someone pressing play. And there's a reason why even the actors in the film or the role they're playing actually hearing the song. And so that's what we try and do. So it was a great collaboration. It's been a fun ride doing it.
Then we get to the scene that I found incredibly offensive. It's revealed that the main character's supposed parents are actually the head of an evil organization and a psychologist from an MK Ultra-like organization, and they have programmed the main character using a music box that plays John Lennon's composition Now and Then. Now, I'm not some conspiracy nut, and I absolutely hate to bring up this subject again, since I reviewed the terrible Apple Computers, not Records, series John Lennon Murder Without a Trial on Episode 2. And when it comes to that event, I frankly hate talking about it, but it can't be ignored as it pertains to this movie. There's a recent book by David Whelan that appears to be very well researched. The book, Mind Games, The Assassination of John Lennon, was recently the subject of a very interesting episode of Robert Rodriguez's Something About the Beatles. As I mentioned on episode 2, and as author Whelan discussed on Satby, the MK Ultra organization's Milton Klein was involved in John's alleged murderer's legal defense, as well as frequently visiting the alleged murderer in prison numerous times. This Dr. Klein, and in addition to Opie's family, the Howards, perhaps we should also keep anyone named Klein away from the Beatles. Anyway, this Dr. Klein bragged in a 1979 TV interview that he could use hypnosis to create a Manchurian candidate, and that's not a candidate that's taken millions of dollars from China, who could be triggered by some conditioned stimulus to commit murder.
I would say that most government agencies concerned with intelligence operations have been looking to hypnosis as a tool for a variety of purposes, one of which is to carry out and to execute certain intelligence operations on a basis where they would not have to rely completely on some of their own emotional reactions.
Actually, would that entail murder?
It could, if you consider that an act of killing someone under circumstances of war is murder. I think one has to define what that means.
Under circumstances of peace.
Under circumstances of peace, it would be murder.
The author of Mind Games believes that the trigger for Lennon's alleged murderer was Catcher in the Rye. And in the movie Argyle, the trigger is the Beatles' Now and Then. It's really inconceivable how no one, and I keep using that word, and I really don't know what it means, but it is really inconceivable that no one at Apple, Jeff Jones, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, Donnie Harrison, Giles Martin, and perhaps most shockingly, Sean Lennon, saw or questioned the abominable irony in this. While Now and Then is played several more times throughout the movie, at one point the characters refer to it as being their song from 5 years earlier. It is once again used as a trigger for the main character to go into a trance-like state in which she attempts to kill her partner, and while this mayhem ensues, we hear the Beatles' last song played over the ultraviolence. One wonders if anyone at Apple Records would have objected if we had heard the inner voice saying, "Do it, do it, do it," while she tried to murder her partner. I'm aghast that Apple et al. Allowed this. Could it be that Zappa was right all along and they're only in it for the money? I may be overreacting here, but this music and that song mean a great deal to me. And I'm guessing if you're bothering to waste your time listening to this podcast, it means a great deal to you as well. Some will say that it's not worth getting upset. It's just a really, 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 really bad, horribly acted, horribly directed, horribly scored crap of a movie with laughable special effects and a seventh grade quality script, so it's not even worth getting upset over. And frankly, I could care less about a $200 million flop directed by a director on the fast slope down, but I do care about the Beatles, and this movie does tarnish the legacy more than any of us would like. Okay, so don't tell anybody, but here's the Atmos mix, and it is far superior.
I know it's true, it's all because of you, and if I make it through, it's all I miss you.
There's a wee comedy fellow who goes by the name of Roy Zimmerman, although truth be told, that doesn't sound like an Irish name now, does it? I knew a Zimmerman from Minnesota, but I don't think they're kin. Anyway, this fella Roy Zimmerman asks a mighty important question. Let's hear him out. Paul McCartney, A Life in Lyrics, is a podcast utilizing the sessions between Paul and Paul Muldoon, henceforth referred to simply as Muldoon, recorded for the book McCartney, The Lyrics, published in 2021, and unfortunately again in 2023, which strikes me as the genesis of this podcast.
I'm Paul Muldoon, a poet, a lover of the lyric poem and the song lyric. And over the past several years, I've been fortunate to spend time with one of the greatest songwriters of our era, Sir Paul McCartney. Together we worked on The Lyrics, 1956 to the present, which looked at more than 150 tracks from McCartney's songbook. When we listened back to the tapes, we realised there was something very special happening in these conversations. As we ventured out on this journey, line by line, it became clear how much of McCartney's biography is indeed embedded in the lyrics.
Has this Liverpool sprung from its people, or have the people sprung from Liverpool?
Going all the way back to his childhood in Liverpool.
It was like going back to an old snapshot album, looking back on work I hadn't thought much about for quite a few years.
This is McCartney, A Life in Lyrics, a masterclass, a memoir, and an improvised journey with one of the most iconic figures in popular music.
The cast dropped on October the 4th of 2023, and season 2 on January 29th, 2024. In keeping with the very loose theme, of course, I'll be looking at an episode that will be available on April the 3rd, 2024. Give Ireland Back to the Irish. The episode starts with a horrifying news soundbite featuring a great deal of screaming and gunfire. Muldoon, who is Irish, gives a brief history of the Troubles, as it's called to this day. On Sunday, January 30th, 1972, British paratroopers shot 26 people who were holding a protest in the Northern Ireland city of Derry. Muldoon called it a peaceful protest, a phrase that sounds like a good war to these ears. A total of 14 people died, and not a soldier boy was bleeding when they nailed the coffin lids. Paul readily admits that he's not a protest songwriter, and some of his subsequent protest songs do confirm this. Paul says he once wrote a song called Angry, but it wasn't angry. I think it kind of sounds like Cheech and Chong's Earache My Eye. Paul asks Muldoon if he was involved in the Troubles. Muldoon says, not actively, and takes the opportunity to read one of his poems. Paul seems to take some measure of pride that the song was banned by the BBC, and some stations in the home of the free inexplicably also chose not to play the song. Whether that was a political or artistic decision, it did, however, hit number one in Ireland, and number one in fascist Spain. Is McCartney: A Life in Lyrics worth listening to? Yes, absolutely. You get to hear Paul talking about many songs that are now woven into what Jung would call the collective consciousness of our modern society. While this episode was about an incredibly weak track, Give Ireland Back to the Irish, which when preceded by Wildlife and followed 2 months later by Mary Had a Little Lamb, had many of us wondering about Paul's future. Fortunately, Hi 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 at the end of the year gave us some relief. But not all of the songs discussed on McCartney: A Life in Lyrics are this week. In fact, most of them are masterpieces, and it's great to hear Paul talking about them. Even if the comments are oft-repeated anecdotes or slightly inaccurate anecdotes, but Cozen and Sinclair provide an acceptable theory on this in their terrific book, The McCartney Legacy. There is a problem with this podcast that I fear I must address. I'm assuming that when Muldoon originally interviewed Paul, there was no intent to use these audio files for anything other than notes to write the book. Paul seems to be eating throughout the book. Either that or he had a stroke that we don't know about. Believe me, I know of what I speak. Then we get to Muldoon, whose affectatious speech pattern sounds like an Irish Paul Harvey. The Beatles started as a club band, playing lunchtime sets at a club called The Cavern. And eventually, their fame grew past the confines of Liverpool, past England and the British Isles, off unto the entire world. It's silly and distracting. As Barth Gimbel would say, if you woke him up in the middle of the night, he would speak normally. But all that aside, McCartney: A Life in Lyrics is a fine companion to the book and an enjoyable listen. So, listen to what the man said.
Yeah.
thank you for listening to I Am the Podman, a Beatles podcast review. I hope you have enjoyed the show. Please remember to like and subscribe. If you have a Beatles-related podcast that you would like me to review, please feel free to email me at iamthepodman@gmail.com. That's iamthepodman@gmail.com. Now it's time to say goodnight. Peace and love. Imagine.